This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents American War by Omar El-Akkad. Read for you by Dion Graham. The one you must punish is the one who punishes you. Kitib El-Hareni, The Book of Songs. Mine heritage is unto me as a speckled bird. The birds round about are against her. Come ye, assemble all the beasts of the field. Come to devour. Jeremiah 12:9. Prologue. When I was young, I collected postcards. I kept them in a shoebox under my bed in the orphanage. Later, when I moved into my first home in New Anchorage, I stored the shoebox at the bottom of an old oil drum in my crumbling tool shed. Having spent most of my life studying the history of war, I found some sense of balance in collecting snapshots of the world that was, idealized and serene. Sometimes I thought about getting rid of the oil drum. I worried someone, a colleague from the university perhaps, would see it and think it a kind of petulant political statement, like the occasional secessionist flag or gutted muscle car outside houses in the old red country. Impotent trinkets of rebellion. Touchstones of a ruined and ruinous past. I am, after all, a southerner by birth, and even though I arrived in neutral country at the age of 6 and never spoke to anyone about my life before then, I couldn't rule out the possibility that some of my colleagues secretly believed I still had a little bit of rebel red in my blood. My favorite postcards are from the 2030s and 2040s, the last decades before the planet turned on the country, and the country turned on itself. They featured pictures of the great ocean beaches before rising waters took them. The images of the Southwest before it turned to embers. Photographs of the Midwestern plains, endless and empty under bluest sky, before the inland exodus filled them with the coastal displaced. A visual reminder of America as it existed in the first half of the 21st century. Soaring, roaring, oblivious. I remember the first postcard I bought. It was a photo of old Anchorage. The city's waterfront is thick with fresh snowfall, the water speckled with shelves of ice, the sun low-strung behind the mountains. I was 6 years old when I saw my first real Alaskan sunset. I stood on the deck of the smuggler's skiff, a sun-bitten Georgia boy, a refugee. I remember feeling the strange white flakes on my eyelashes, the involuntary rattle of my teeth, feeling for the first time in my life, cold. I saw near the tops of the mountains that frozen yoke suspended in the sky, and thought I had reached the very terminus of the living world. The very end of movement. I belong to what they call the miraculous generation. Those born in the years between the start of the Second American Civil War in 2074 and its end in 2095. Some extend the definition further, including those born during the decade-long plague that followed the end of the war. This country has a long history of defining its generations by the conflicts that should have killed them, and my generation is no exception. We are the few who escaped the wrath of the homicide bombers and the warring birds, the few who are spirited into well-stocked cellars or tornado shelters before the reunification plague spread across the continent, the few who are just plain lucky. I've spent my professional career studying this country's bloody war with itself. I've written academic papers and magazine articles, headlined myriad symposiums and workshops. I've studied all the surviving source documents, congressional reports, oral histories, harrowing testimony of the plague's survivors. I've reconstructed the infamous events of Reunification Day, when one of the South's last remaining rebels managed to sneak into the Union capital and unleashed the sickness that cast the country into a decade of death. It is estimated that 11 million people died in the war, and almost 10 times that number in the plague that followed. I've received countless letters from readers and critics taking issue with all manner of historical minutiae, whether the rebels were really responsible for a particular homicide bombing, whether the massacre at such and such really was as bad as the Southern propagandists claim. My files contain hundreds of such correspondences. All variations on the same theme, that I, a coddled New Anchorage northerner, a neutral country elite who'd never seen a day of real fighting, don't know the first thing about the war. But there are things I know that nobody else knows. I know because she told me. And my knowing makes me complicit. Now, as I near the end of my life, I've been inspecting the accumulated miscellanea of my youth. Recently I found that first postcard I bought. It's been more than 100 years since its photograph was taken. All but the sea and the mountains are gone. New Anchorage, a sprawl of low buildings and affluent suburbs nestled at the foot of the hills, has moved further inland over the years. The docks where I once arrived as a disoriented war orphan have been raised and reinforced time and time again. And where once there stood wharfs of knotted wood, there are now modular platforms designed to be dismantled and relocated quickly. Fierce storms come without warning. Sometimes I stroll along the New Anchorage waterfront, past the wharf and the harbor. It's the closest I can come now to my original arrival point in the neutral country, without renting a scavenger's boat. My doctor says it's good to walk regularly, and that I should try to keep doing so as long as it doesn't cause me pain. I suspect this is the sort of harmless pablum he feeds all his terminal patients. Those who long ago graduated from "this will help" to "this can't hurt." It's a strange thing to be dying. For so long, I thought the end of my life would come suddenly, when the plague found its way north to the neutral country, or the Red rebelled once more, and we were plunged into another bout of fratricide. Instead, I've been sentenced to that most ordinary of deaths, an overabundance of malfunctioning cells. I read once that a moderately ravenous cancer is, in a pragmatic sense, a decent way to die. Not so prolonged as to entail years of suffering, but affording enough time that one might have a chance to make the necessary arrangements, to say what needs to be said. It hasn't snowed in years, but every now and then, in late January, we'll get a fractal of frost crawling up the windows. On those days, I like to go out to the waterfront and watch my breath hang in the air. I feel unburdened. I am no longer afraid. I stand at the edge of the boardwalk and watch the water. I think of all the things it has taken, and all that was taken from me. Sometimes, I stare out at the sea for hours, well past dark, until I am elsewhere in time and elsewhere in place, back in the battered Red country where I was born. And that's when I see her again, rising out of the water. She is exactly as I remember her, a hulking, bronzed body, her back lined with ashen scars, each one a testimony to the torture she was made to endure, the secret crimes committed against her. She rises, a flesh monolith reborn from the severed belly of the Savannah. And I am a child again, yet to be taken from my parents and my home, yet to be betrayed. I am back home by the riverbank, and I am happy. And I still love her. My secret is, I still love her. This isn't a story about war. It's about ruin. 1. April 2075. St. James, Louisiana. Chapter 1.
I was happy then.
The sun broke through a pilgrimage of clouds and cast its unblinking eye upon the Mississippi Sea.
The coastal waters were brown and still. The sea's mouth opened wide over ruined marshland, and every year grew wider, the water picking away at the silt and sand and clay, until the old riverside plantations and plastics factories and marine railways became unstable. Before the buildings slid into the water for good, they were stripped of their usable parts by the Delta's last holdout residents. The water swallowed the land. To the southeast, the once glorious city of New Orleans became a well within the walls of its levees, the baptismal rites of a new America. A little girl, 6 years old, sat on the porch of her family's home under a clapboard awning. She held a plastic container of honey, which was made in the shape of a bear. From the top of its head, golden liquid slid out under the cheap pine floorboard. The girl poured the honey into the wood's deep knots,
and watched the serpentine manner in which the liquid took to the contours of its new surroundings. This is her earliest memory, the moment she begins. And this is how, in those moments when the bitterness subsides, I choose to remember her. A child. I wish I had known her then, in those years when she was still unbroken.
Sarah Chestnut, what do you think you're doing?
Said the girl's mother, standing behind her near the door of the shipping container in which the Chestnuts made their home.
What did I tell you about wasting what's not yours to waste?
Sorry, Mama.
Did you work to buy that, honey?
Hmm?
No, I didn't think you did. Go get your sister and get your butt to breakfast before your daddy leaves.
Okay, Mama,
the girl said, handing back the half-empty container. She ducked past her mother, who patted dirt from the seat of her fleur-de-lis dress. Her name was Sarah T. Chestnut, but she called herself Sarat. The latter was born of a misunderstanding at the schoolhouse earlier that year. The new kindergarten teacher accidentally read the girl's middle initial as the last letter of her first name. Sarat. To the little girl's ears, the new name had a bite to it. Sarah ended with an impotent exhale, a fading ah that disappeared into the air. Sarat snapped shut like a bear trap. A few months later, the school shut down, most of the teachers and students forced northward by the encroaching war. But the name stuck. Sarat. 100 feet from the western riverbank, the Chestnuts lived in a corrugated steel container salvaged from a nearby shipyard. Wedges of steel plating anchored to cement blocks below the ground held the home in place. At the corners, a brown rust crept slowly outward, incubated in ceaseless humidity. A lattice of old-fashioned solar panels lined the entirety of the roof, save for one corner occupied by a rainwater tank. A tarp rested near the panels. When storms approached, the tarp was pulled over the roof with ropes tied to its ends and laced through hooks. By guiding the rainfall away from the panels to the tank and, when it overfilled, toward the land and river below, the family was able to collect drinking water and defend their home from rust and decay. Sometimes, during winter storms, the family took shelter on the porch, where the awning sagged and leaked, but spared them the unbearable acoustics of the shipping container under heavy rain, which sounded like the bowl of a calypso drum. In the summer, when their house felt like a steel kiln, the family spent much of their time outdoors. It was during this extended season, which burned from March through mid-December, that Sarat, her fraternal twin, Dana, and her older brother, Simon, experienced their purest instances of childhood joy. Under the distant watch of their parents, the children would fill buckets of water from the river and use them to drench the clay embankment until it became a slide. Entire afternoons and evenings were spent this way, the children careening down the greased earth into the river and climbing back up with the aid of a knotted rope, squealing with delight on the way down, their backsides leaving deep grooves in the clay. In a coop behind the house, the family kept an emaciated clutch of chickens. They were loud and moved nervously, their feathers dirty and brown. When they were fed and the weather was not too hot, they produced eggs. In other times, if they were on the edge of revolt or death, they were preemptively slaughtered, their necks pinned down between the nails in a nearby stump. The shipping container was segmented by standing clavards. Benjamin and Martina Chestnut lived in the back of the home. 9-year-old Simon and the 6-year-old twins shared the middle third, living in a peace that grew more and more uneasy by the day. In the final third of the home, there was a small kitchen table of sand-colored plywood, smeared and notched from years of heavy use. Near the table, a pine pantry and jelly cabinet held sweet potatoes, rice, bags of chips and sugar cereal, pecans, flour, and pebbles of grain milled from the sorghum fields that separated the Chestnuts from their nearest neighbor. In a compact fridge that burdened the solar panels, the family kept milk and butter and cans of old Coke. By the front door, a statue from the days of Benjamin's childhood kept vigil. It was the Virgin of Guadalupe, cast in ceramic, her hands pressed against each other, her head lowered in prayer. A beaded bouquet of yellow tickseed and white water lilies lay at her feet, alongside a melted, magnolia-scented candle. When the flowers died and hardened, the children were sent out to the fields to find more.
Surratt skipped past the statue, looking for her sister. She found her in the back of the house, standing on her parents' bed, inspecting with steel concentration her reflection in the oval vanity mirror. She had taken one of her mother's house dresses, a simple sleeveless tunic whose violet color held, despite countless washings. The little girl wore the top half of the dress, which covered the entirety of her frame. The rest of the garment slid limply off the bed and onto the floor. She had applied, far too generously, her mother's cherry red lipstick, the jewel of the simple makeup set her mother owned but rarely used. Despite employing utmost delicacy, Dana could not keep within the lines of her small pink lips, and looked now as though she'd hastily eaten a strawberry pie.
"Come play with me,"
Surratt said, confounded by what her twin was doing. Dana turned to her sister, annoyed.
"I'm busy,"
she said.
"But I'm bored. I'm being a lady."
Dana returned to her mirror, trying to wipe some of the lipstick with the back of her hand.
"Mama says we have to go have breakfast with Daddy now."
"Okay, okay,"
Dana said.
"Not a moment peace in this house,"
she added, misquoting a thing she'd heard her mother say on occasion. Surratt was the second-born girl, 5.5 minutes behind her sister, and although she'd been told by her parents that both she and Dana were made of the same flesh, Dana was her father's girl, with his easygoing wit and sincere smile. Surratt was made of her mother, stubborn, hard, undaunted by calamity. They were twins, but they were not alike. Surratt often heard her mother use the word tomboy to describe her. "God gave me two children at once," she said, "but only girl enough for one." For a few minutes after Dana had left, Surratt remained in her parents' room. She observed with some confusion the thing her sister had smeared all over her lips. Unlike the river and the bush and the beasts and birds of the natural world, the lipstick did not interest her. It held no promise of adventure. She knew it only as a prop in her twin sister's ongoing obsession with adulthood. Why Dana wished so desperately to join the ranks of the fully grown, Surratt could not understand. Dana emerged from the house, still draped in her mother's clothes.
"Didn't I tell you not to go opening my dresser?"
Martina said.
"Sorry, Mama."
"Don't sorry me. And pull it up. You're dragging dirt everywhere."
Martina pulled the dress off her daughter.
"I sent your sister in to get you, and now you're out here looking like a mess, and she's inside probably doing the same."
"She can't put makeup on,"
said Dana.
"She's ugly."
Martina knelt down and grabbed her daughter by the shoulders.
"Don't ever say that, you hear me? Don't ever call her ugly. Don't ever say a bad word about her. She's your sister. She's a beautiful girl."
Dana lowered her head and pouted. Martina cupped her jaw and lifted her head back up.
"Listen to me," she said. "You go back inside and you tell her. You tell her she's a beautiful girl."
Dana stomped back inside the house. She found her sister putting her mother's lipstick back in the makeup box.
"You're a beautiful girl,"
Dana said, and stormed out of the room. For a moment, Surratt stood dumbstruck. She was a child still, and the purpose of a lie eluded her. She couldn't yet fathom that someone would say something if they didn't believe it. She smiled. Outside, Martina cooked breakfast on a heavy firewood stove. On the plates and in the bowls, there were hard biscuits and sorghum cereal and fried eggs and imitation pepper bacon cooked till crisp in its own fat. In her slumping cheeks and dark-circled eyes, Martina's 39 years were plainly visible, more so than in the face of her husband, although he was 5 years her senior, and the two of them had lived half their lives together. She was wide around her midsection, but not obese, with an organic rural fitness that made her able, when it was necessary, to lift heavy loads and walk long distances. Unlike her husband, who had sneaked into the country from Mexico as a child, back when the flow of migrants still moved northward, she was not an immigrant. She was born into the place she lived.
"Breakfast!"
Martina shouted, wiping the sweat from her brow with a ragged dish towel.
Get over here now, all of you. I won't say it again.
Benjamin emerged from behind the house, freshly shaven and showered in the family's outdoor stall.
Hurry up and eat before he gets here, Martina said.
It's all right, relax, her husband replied. When's he ever been on time?
Where's your good tie?
It's not a job interview, just a work permit. I'm only going to a government office, no different than the post office.
When was the last time people killed one another to get something from a post office?
Benjamin sat at the table in the yard. He was a lean man with a lean face, his near-touching brows anchoring a smooth, large forehead made larger by setting baldness at the temples. He was at all times clean-shaven, save for a thin black mustache his wife worried made him look unseemly. He kissed Surratt on the forehead, and when he saw his other daughter, her face smeared with red, kissed her too.
Your girl's been at it again, Martina said. Won't learn manners, won't do what they're told.
Benjamin shook his head at Dana with mock disapproval, then he leaned close to her ear.
I think it looks good on you, he whispered.
Thanks, Daddy,
Dana whispered back. The family assembled around the table. Martina called out for Simon, and soon he came around the front porch, carrying in his hands the recently sawed bottom half of the family's 10-rung ladder. Seeing the look on his mother's face, the 8-year-old blurted,
Dad asked me to do it.
Martina turned to her husband, who bit happily into the bacon and drank the sour, grainy coffee. It was rancid stuff from the ration packs, designed to keep soldiers awake.
Don't look at me like that. Smith needs a ladder, Benjamin said. Got new shingles to put up. Old ones have all gone to mush.
So you're going to give him half of ours?
It's a fair enough deal, considering he's the one who knows the man at the permit office. Without him, we may as well try to shoot our way across the border.
He's got enough money to buy himself a million ladders, said Martina. I thought you said he was doing us a favor.
Benjamin chuckled.
A northern work permit for half a ladder is still a favor.
Martina poured the last of her coffee in the dirt.
We need to get up and fix our roof just the same as the Smiths, she said.
We don't need any more than a 5-rung ladder to do it, Benjamin replied. Especially now that our own boy's grown tall and strong enough to get himself up there.
It was a point with which Simon vehemently agreed, promising his mother he'd climb up regularly to add chlorine to the tank and clean the bird droppings from the solar panels, just like his father did. The family ate together. Benjamin, rail thin his whole life, inhaled the bacon and eggs with shameless appetite. His son looked on, cataloging his father's every minute ritual into an ironclad manual of what it means to be a man. Soon the boy, too, had wiped his plate clean. The twins sipped orange juice from plastic cups and picked at their biscuits until their mother softened the bread with a smear of butter and apricot jam, and then they ate quietly, deep in guarded thought. Martina watched her husband, her eyes still and silent, a look her children mistook for hardness, but her husband knew to be just how she was. Finally, she said,
Don't tell them nothing about doing any work for the Free Southerners.
It's no secret, Benjamin replied. They know full well every man around these parts has done some work for the Free Southerners. Doesn't mean I picked up a rifle for them.
But you don't have to say it. If you say it, then they have to check one of the boxes on the form and take you into another room and ask you all kinds of other questions. And then in the end, they won't give you a permit on account of security reasons or whatever they call it. Just say you work in the shirt factory.
That's not a lie. Quit worrying so much, Benjamin said, leaning back in his seat and picking the stray meat from between his teeth.
They'll give us a permit. The North needs workers. We need work.
Simon interjected.
Why do we need to go to the North? We don't know anybody up there.
They got jobs there, his mother replied. They got schools there. You're always complaining about not having enough toys, enough friends, enough everything. Well, up there they have plenty.
Connor says going to the North is for traitors, says they should hang.
Surratt listened intently to the conversation, filing the strange new word in her mind. Traders. It sounded exotic. A foreign tribe, perhaps?
Don't talk like that,
Martina said. You gonna listen to your mother or a 10-year-old boy? Simon looked down at his plate and mumbled, Connor's dad told him. They finished eating and retreated to the porch. Martina sat on the steps and cleaned the lipstick from her daughter's face with a wet dish rag, the girl squirming and whining. Simon smoothed the ends of the half ladder with a sandpaper block, putting his whole weight into the job, until his father told him he didn't have to work it so hard. Surratt returned to the scene of her morning experiment, poking at the congealed honey thick in the knots of the wood, enthralled by the amber liquid's viscosity. It fascinated her, how the thing so readily took the shape of its vessel. With her pinky, she cracked the crust and tasted a dollop. She expected the honey to taste like wood, but it still tasted like itself. Benjamin sat on a hickory chair, the weaves of its backrest frayed and peeling. He looked out at the brown, barren river and waited on his patron to arrive.
Do you know what you're going to say to them at the permit place?
Martina asked.
Have you thought it through?
I'll answer what they ask.
You got your papers ready?
I got my papers ready.
Martina shook her head and cast an eye out for signs of an incoming boat.
Probably there won't even be any permits, she said. Probably they'll do what they always do and turn us back. That's their way. Don't give a damn about nobody south of the mag line. It's like we aren't human, aren't animal even. Like we're something else entirely.
They'll just turn you back. I know it.
Benjamin shrugged.
Do you want me to go or not?
You know I do.
When she was done wiping the lipstick, Martina set to braiding Dana's hair. It came down in long, smooth strands of the deepest black, unlike Surratt's, which, although the same color, was unruly and revolted to fuzz in the humidity.
You girls know what the best thing about the North is?
She asked.
What?
Surratt replied.
Well, you know how at night here it gets so hot, you just can't take it, and you wake up with your sheets all damp with sweat?
I hate that,
Dana said.
Well, when you get far enough north, it never gets hot that way. And in the winter, if you go really far north, they don't even have rain. They have little balls of ice that drop from the sky, and the ground gets all thick with it till you can't see the roads anymore, and the rivers get so cold they turn to solid rock you can walk on.
That's silly, Dana said.
In her mind, these were more of her parents' elaborate fairy tales, the hardening rivers and falling ice, no different than the fish with whiskers that her father said once swam in great schools through the lifeless Mississippi, back when it was just a river, or the ancient lizards buried in the deserts to the west, whose remains once powered the world. Dana didn't believe any of it. But Surratt did. Surratt believed every word.
It's true,
Martina said.
Cool in the summer, cool in the winter. Temperate, they call it. And safe, too. Kids out in the streets playing till late at night. You'll make friends your first day there.
Simon shook his head quietly. He knew that even as she talked to the twins, his mother was really addressing him. With everyone else, she spoke directly, with no sentimentality or euphemism. But to her only son, whose inner mental workings she feared she would never learn to decipher, she passed messages through intermediaries in weak, obvious code. Simon hated it. Why couldn't she be like his father? He wondered. Why couldn't she simply say what she meant? By mid-morning, Benjamin's ride had yet to appear. Soon, Martina began to believe her husband had been forgotten. Or perhaps Benjamin's acquaintance had finally been caught in that old fossil-powered boat of his and had been arrested. It was true that the states surrounding the rebel red, a cocoon formed by Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina, were deeply sympathetic to the cause of the free southern state. And even though residents of these states still required a permit to move north to the real heart of the Blue Country, the states were officially members of the Union nonetheless, and a man caught using fossil fuel in these parts was still an outlaw.
She thought about how much easier it would be for everyone if all these would-be statelets were simply allowed to break free from the Union, to form their own miniature nations along the fault lines of region or creed or race or ideology. Everyone knew there had always been fissures. In the Northwest, they were constantly threatening to declare the independence of the proud, pacifist Cascadia. South of Cascadia, so much of California, Nevada, Arizona, and West Texas was already under the informal control of the Mexican forces, the map of that corner of the continent slowly reverting to what it was hundreds of years ago. In the Midwest, the old stock nativists harbored a barely restrained animosity toward the millions of coastal refugees who descended onto the middle of the country to escape rising seas and severe storms. And here, in the South, an entire region decided to wage war again, to sever itself from the Union, rather than stop using that illicit fuel responsible for so much of the country's misfortune. Sometimes, it seemed to Martina that there had never been a Union at all, that long ago some disinterested or opportunistic party had drawn lines on a map where previously there were none, and in the process created a single country fashioned from many different countries. How bad would it really be, she wondered, if the federal government in Columbus simply stopped wasting so much money and blood trying to hold the fractured continent together? Let the Southerners keep their outdated fuel, she thought, until they pulled every last drop of it from the beaten ground. Martina watched the river and waited for the boat to come. She saw Surratt near the water, inspecting a discarded shrimp net that had washed up on shore a few months earlier. The children had made from it a makeshift trap for river debris. The net collected all manner of strange treasure. An iron cross, a neck rest from a barber's chair, a laminated picture of a long-shuttered leper colony, a small sign that read, "Please, no profanity in the canteen." Surratt inspected the soggy pages of a waterlogged book caught in the net. The book's title was The Changing Earth. Its cover featured a picture of a huge blue mountain of floating ice. She leafed gingerly through the pages, peeling them from one another. The book was filled with maps of the world, old and new. The new maps looked like the old ones, but with the edges of the land shaved off. Whole islands, gone. Coastlines retreating into their continents. In the old maps, America looked bigger. She saw the shadow of her brother, Simon, standing behind her.
"What is it?"
he said, snatching at the book.
"None of your business," Surratt replied. "I found it first."
She pulled the book away and hopped to her feet, ready to fight him for it, if she had to.
"Whatever," Simon said. "I don't even want it. It's just a dumb book."
But she could see him inspecting the open page.
"Do you even know what that is?"
he asked.
"It's maps," Surratt said. "I know what maps are."
Simon pointed to a corner of the page where the blue of water seemed to overwhelm a few thin shreds of land on the southern edge of the continent.
"That's us, stupid," he said. "That's where we live."
Surratt looked at the place on the map where Simon pointed. It looked wholly abstract, in no way reminiscent of her home.
"You see all that water?" Simon said. "That all used to be land, and now it's gone."
He pointed back in the direction of their house.
"And one day, this'll all be water, too. We'll have to get out of here, or else we'll drown."
Surratt saw the faint smirk on her brother's face and knew instantly he was trying to scare her. She wondered why he seemed so obsessed with such tricks, why he so often tried to say things in the hopes of making her react in some fearful or foolish way. He was 3 years older than she was, and a boy, a different species altogether. But still, she sensed in her brother a kind of insecurity, as though trying to scare her was not some cruel way to pass the time, but a vital means of proving something to himself. She wondered if all boys were like this, their meanness of self-defense. And anyway, she knew he was a liar. The water would never eat their home. Maybe the rest of Louisiana, maybe the rest of the world, but never their home. Their home would remain on dry land, because that was the way it had always been. Late in the morning, Benjamin's acquaintance, Alder Smith, arrived. He was 4 hours late,
His plywood fishing skiff bobbed softly on the parting water, its outboard motor gurgling and coughing fumes. It was an archaic thing, but still faster and nimbler than the Sea-Tocs, whose feeble, solar-fed motors barely beat the current. It said something to own a vehicle that still ran on Prohibition fuel. It spoke not only of accumulated wealth, but of connections, of status.
"Morning,"
Smith said, as he ushered the boat to the foot of the Chestnut's landing, throwing a loop of nylon around the docking pole. Like Benjamin, he was tall, but boasted broader shoulders and a full head of brown hair made copper by too much time in the sun. Before the war, his father owned a dozen fossil car dealerships between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Those businesses were now long gone, but the wealth they bore still lingered, and Smith lived a comfortable life on the other side of the river. Among the families that still dotted the flooded south of Louisiana and Mississippi, he was known as a facilitator, a man who had plenty of friends. He knew free southern state government men in Atlanta and the smugglers who ran the tunnels across the Mississippi-Arkansas line. He knew consuls in the federal offices that dotted the tamed and broken parts of the Union-aligned south. He even claimed to know the right-hand men of senators and congressmen in the federal capital in Columbus.
"Morning," Martina replied. "Come on up. We got some sandwiches left. Coffee, too."
"Thank you kindly, but we're already late. Come on, Ben. Blues don't like waiting."
Benjamin kissed his wife and children goodbye and stepped inside to kiss the feet of the ceramic virgin. He descended to the river with great care so as to keep from slipping in the clay and dirtying his good pants. He carried with him his old leather briefcase and the half ladder. His wife watched from the edge of the flat land.
"Dock south and walk into the city," she told the man. "Don't let any government people see that boat."
Smith laughed and started the motor.
"Don't you worry," he said. "This time next week, you'll be halfway to Chicago."
"Just be good,"
Martina said.
"Be careful, I mean."
The man pushed the skiff from the mud and pointed the hull north in the direction of Baton Rouge. The boat rumbled into the narrowing heart of the great brown river, twin spires of water rising and spreading in its wake. Excerpted from Federal Syllabus Guidelines, History, Module 8, The Second Civil War. Module Summary. The Second American Civil War took place between the years of 2074 and 2095. The war was fought between the Union and the secessionist states of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina, as well as Texas prior to the Mexican annexation. The primary cause of the war was Southern resistance to the Sustainable Future Act, a bill prohibiting the use of fossil fuels anywhere in the United States. The bill, championed by President Daniel Key, was in part a response to decades of adverse climate effects, the waning economic importance of fossil fuels, and a deadly oil train derailment in Williston, North Dakota, in 2069. The war's key precipitating events include the assassination of President Key by secessionist suicide bomber Julia Templestowe in Jackson, Mississippi, in December of 2073. And the deaths of Southern protesters in a shooting outside the Fort Jackson, South Carolina military base in March of 2074. The secessionist states, unified under the banner of the Free Southern State, declared independence on October 1st, 2074, the date often considered to mark the formal start of the war. Following a series of decisive Union military victories in the first 5 years of the war, primarily in East Texas and along the northern borders of Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, the MAG, the fighting largely subsided. However, rebel insurrectionist groups continued to engage in sporadic guerrilla violence for another half decade, aided in part by foreign agents and anti-American saboteurs. After a drawn-out negotiation process that was settled largely in the Union's favor, the war was set to formally conclude with the Reunification Day ceremony in the federal capital of Columbus, Ohio, on July 3, 2095. On that day, a secessionist terrorist managed to cross the border into Northern Territory and release a biological agent, the Reunification Plague, that resulted in a nationwide epidemic. The effects of the plague,
which claimed an estimated 110 million lives, were felt throughout much of the country for the next 10 years. The identity of the terrorist responsible remains unknown. Chapter 2. On the porch railing, the chestnuts kept a bowl lined with oil to trap mosquitoes. Lured by the glistening liquid, the insects landed and became ensnared. Surratt stood on the porch, the sun hot on her forehead. She watched the mosquitoes squirm. They were heavy black dots, plump as grapes. She picked one between her thumb and forefinger. She held it close to her eye. It showed no signs of what the little girl associated with living things. It said nothing, made no sound, unlike the chirping crickets or the chickens when they were worked into a frenzy. But she knew, nonetheless, that the thing between her fingers was alive. Surratt pressed her fingers together and the mosquito burst under the pressure, leaving behind a black stain.
"What are you doing?"
Dana asked, her approach from within the house unnoticed by her twin. Surratt startled.
"Nothing,"
she said. Dana inspected her sister's fingers.
"That's gross,"
she said finally, and walked away. Surratt wiped her fingers on the rough denim of her overalls. They were hand-me-downs from her brother, their copper buttons turned black with age. She wore them plain, with nothing underneath. When the weather was very warm, she undid the straps and tied them around her waist as a kind of belt, where they held at most for a few minutes before coming loose and dragging in the dirt. She couldn't understand why her sister derived no fascination from exploring the tiny living worlds all around them, worlds whose myriad secrets lay ripe for the taking. The flying balls of blood trapped in the bowl, the eyes of the pine floorboards laced with honey, worms picked by her father's hand and impaled on hooks to teach the children a ritual from the days when the river still carried fish. Dana found such things tedious or repulsive, but to Surratt, they were the veins and arteries through which life's magic flowed. Martina Chestnut stood on the grass between her home and the sorghum field. She hung wet clothes on a line drawn between a hook and one of the porch beams and the remains of a beach umbrella wedged into the dirt. Like the tarp that covered the roof panels, the beach umbrella had washed up on the shore a couple of years earlier and was immediately put to use. Martina folded each garment over the line, pinching the clothes in place with pegs. Droplets fell from the cuffs of the pants and the ends of the shirts. Here, under the line, the grass grew a little greener. The clothes were plain, inoffensive, white and beige of varying shades. After so much use, many of the garments had taken on a ghostly translucence. In some parts of the mag, where the rebels held most sway, there were families who dyed their denim red to avoid trouble. But to the sleepy Louisiana coast, such concerns had yet to come. 1,000 miles away, out by the eastern seaboard, there were newer clothes to be had, unloaded monthly from the aid ships that arrived from distant empires, cheap robes and polo shirts and track suits and baseball caps, many of them bearing the logos of the Golden Bulls or LLE, or the other popular sports clubs. But these were invariably snatched as soon as they reached the Georgia docks, and were, at least on paper, illegal to sell or transfer anywhere outside the three secessionist states of Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. Of course, this rule was routinely flouted, but by the time the garments made their way as far as Louisiana or Arkansas or west to the Mexican protectorate, they'd already gone through multiple middlemen and were, for most residents, unaffordable. Since the earliest days of the Civil War, the secessionist states survived on the charity of foreign superpowers. Once, fossil fuels were a worthwhile currency, valuable enough to keep the Louisiana ports and Texas refineries economically viable, even if not flush with cash like in the previous century. But as the rest of the world learned to live off the sun and the wind and the splitting and crashing of atoms, the old fuel became archaic and nearly worthless. The refineries were shuttered, and the drills were abandoned, even as the rebel states chose open warfare over prohibition. Now, with the South on the losing end of the conflict and its resources running dry, its people came to rely more and more on the massive ships that arrived every month from the other side of the planet, stocked with food, clothing, and other human necessities. The ships came from the newborn superpowers, China and the Boazizi Empire, the latter of which, only a few decades earlier, was nothing more than a collection of failed and failing nations spread across the Middle East and North Africa. But that was before the Fifth Spring Revolution finally toppled the old regimes. Now, in place of those old, broken states, was a single entity stretching from the Gibraltar Pass in the state of Morocco all the way to the edges of the Black and Caspian Seas. At dusk, when the heat died down, Eliza Polk came over for dinner. She lived a mile north along the riverbank and through the grain field, and was the chestnut's closest neighbor. The summer previous, she had lost her husband and both teenage sons in one of the battles in East Texas. On account of her fevered, months-long mourning and her refusal to wear anything but plain black dresses every day since, the chestnut children called her Santa Muerte behind her back. It was a phrase they picked up from their father. She was 48 years old, but looked a decade older, made so by her stooped posture and the brittle shiver of her voice. In the year since her family's obliteration in the battlefields of East Texas, she lived simply on a widow's pension from one of the rebel groups. In addition to her pension, she received assistance in other ways. Every few weeks, a Mississippi Sovereign's boat could be seen coming across the river. Upon arrival, two or three unsmiling young men would go about trimming the yard and cleaning the house and providing the diminutive widow more food and clothing than she could ever eat or wear. Polk handed much of the excess provisions over to the chestnuts, her part of an unspoken agreement that the family, in return, provide the lonely woman some company to pass the hot, interminable days. When she arrived, Polk hugged her neighbor tightly and asked if she'd heard from her husband. Martina said she had not.
"He's safe, honey, don't you worry," Polk said. "The Lord watches over him. I know it in my heart."
Polk brought with her a mud pie. She set it on the porch railing. She stepped around the house and said hello to Simon, who was perched on the amputated ladder, struggling to hoist himself onto the roof, prohibited by pride from asking his mother for help. She sat down on one of the hickory chairs and wiped the sweat away from her forehead, and called for the twins. Dana, who was busy playing house, did not emerge, but Surratt did.
"Well, hello, darling. Don't you look pretty today?"
Polk said, kissing Surratt on the cheek and trying, as she often did, to slick back her fuzzy, upturned hair.
"Hi, Santa,"
Surratt said. As always, the woman assumed she'd earned this nickname as a result of all the gifts she'd given the family. When she was finished hanging the laundry, Martina walked to the porch and sat beside her guest. The two women sipped on sweet tea, and as the daylight faded, they watched the children play. At the riverbank, Simon kept a simple raft tethered to a stump. The raft was made of a plywood sheet on empty oil drums, and in its center stood a crucifix mast of sanded branches on which was draped a bedsheet sail. Even in the best of winds, the sail did nothing, but was decorated in black marker with a crude Jolly Roger and was kept in place to strike fear into the hearts of passing craft, or so Simon hoped. When the water was calm, Simon was allowed to take the raft on his own as far as the midpoint of the river, rowing madly with a scoop shovel. But if the girls were with him, he had to stay close to the shore. And at all times, he had to keep the boat tethered.
"I'm sure the boys are fine, Martina,"
Polk said again.
"You know how those government offices are. Probably told them it'd take a day or two to get the paperwork sorted. They're probably staying overnight so they don't have to go upriver a second time. Probably having the time of their lives at the home and away, I bet."
Martina shook her head.
"He'd come home. If there were 3 hours to kill, he'd come home."
Polk sipped her tea and retreated into the past, where she spent most of her mind's days.
"You know, when the rebels sent news about Henry and the boys, I told them to bury me with them. Bury me in the same grave, because I can't go on alone. Life's not worth living alone. But you know, when I saw them, just before they lay them down in the martyr's grave out by the Mexican border with the rest of those brave men, They looked as calm and clean as I'd ever seen them. Even the bullet wounds weren't like you see in the pictures, all a mess like that. They were just little holes. You'd see them and think, how could something so little end a life? I was so scared before I saw them. I thought that they'd look bad, ruined. But they didn't. They didn't at all. They looked peaceful, Martina. They looked happy.
I thought you said my husband's going to be fine, Martina said.
Of course, honey, of course he will be,
Polk said.
She paused for a moment and then continued softly.
But all I'm saying is if, God forbid, if something were to have happened, if the blues were to have done something to him, there would be no shame in it. We'd remember him as a proud Southern patriot, no different than my boys.
Martina tossed the last of the sweet tea from her glass on the dirt.
We ain't patriots of the South or any place else. We were trying, we are trying, to get out. We're going to the North. We ain't patriots, and we ain't got any martyrs.
Polk touched Martina's shoulder.
Of course, of course. And there's no shame in going, either. I know you want to do what's best for your children, and it's safer up there, no doubt. They don't have to go through what we go through. But you're not of them. There's no sin in making a safer life for your children. And maybe when they're old enough to make decisions for themselves, they can come back to their own country. But you're not of them. You're still Southerners in your bones. You're still Southerners in your blood. That won't ever change.
We're a family,
Martina said, her eyes set on the bend to the north, beyond which it was impossible to see any further upriver.
We're nothing else.
From beyond the bend, a sound carried ahead of its source. It was not the gurgling noise of Smith's fossil skiff, but something that cut smoother through the water. A bigger boat. For a moment, Martina thought it was one of the rebels' smuggling ships, out earlier in the evening than usual. She yelled for her children to come back to shore, and they did, hustling up the slippery bank with their feet caked in mud. But when the boat came around the bend, its spotlights cast sharp circles on the black water. Martina knew rebel ships run dark. It was a State River Monitor, a 20-foot launch operated out of Baton Rouge. Nominally, it was supposed to help keep the rebels from running arms across the river to and from the Texas oil fields and the Mexican protectorate. It moved slow and conspicuous, with glowing solar panels extending out from port and starboard like butterfly wings. The panels were intended to power the boat. Only in emergencies was the backup diesel motor to be used. But in practice, the officers quickly tired of the panels and their anemic batteries, and out on the water they used, almost exclusively, the fuel whose prohibition they were supposed to enforce. Martina knew the kind of men who worked on these boats. They were Southerners, all of them, employed by the Mississippi River Protection Agency, or the Department of Emergency Security, or a dozen other state bureaucracies that were state-run in name only, conceived solely to fulfill Northern wartime objectives. The officers went by the nickname Blue Badges, and in rebel parlance, these men were said to owe money to the madam. Once or twice a month, a Blue Badge would go missing somewhere along the Mississippi border. His body was usually found a few days later hanging from the twisted branch of a curling catalpa, the lining cut from his pants pockets and stuffed in his mouth. Such were the fortunes of accused traitors, not only in the secessionist country, but in neighboring states whose populace sympathized with the rebels, even as their governments sided with the North.
"It's Benjamin," said Martina, watching the boat change its trajectory, shifting in the direction of the chestnut's place.
"Something's happened to him.
Blue Badges don't come out here this late at night if they can help it."
"Just calm down. Don't start getting all those ideas," Polk said. "It's probably nothing."
But Martina was already out of her chair and headed for the bank. Midway, she met her children coming back from the river. They walked with their heads turned back, fixated on the incoming boat.
"Gone inside," Martina said. The girls did as they were told, but Simon did not.
"They're gonna say something about Dad, aren't they?
I'm not a baby. I'm old enough to know. Without speaking, Martina turned and slapped her son across the face. The boy, stung and reddened, was left speechless. So lengthy were the intervals between those moments when his mother's innate hard strength showed itself that the boy was often lulled into forgetting it existed at all. "Go inside," Martina repeated to her son, in whose eyes tears of shock and anger had already begun to well. His face hardened with spite. But this time, he complied. The boat docked against the clay bank, and two men in drab brown uniforms came ashore. Their clothes resembled sheriff's uniforms. Pinned to their breasts were stumpy, plastic-looking badges. One man was tall and thick-set. His hair was buzzed close enough to show the pink of his scalp, and even without seeing, Martina could tell there were small rolls of fat on the back of his neck. The shorter man was of slim build, and appeared to be about 10 years older than his partner, who himself could not have been more than 21. The shorter man carried with him a slim paper folder, whose contents he repeatedly consulted by the light of his flashlight.
"Are you Martina Chestnut?" he asked finally.
"What happened to him?"
Martina replied.
"Wife of Benjamin Chestnut?"
"Tell me what happened to him."
The officer spoke in a deadened monotone, refusing to look up from the notes in his folder.
"Miss Chestnut, at 1:17 in the afternoon on April 1st, 2075, an insurrectionist detonated a homicide bomb in the lobby of the Federal Services Building in Baton Rouge."
The rest of the officer's speech floated by Martina, unheard. Her vision darkened and narrowed, such that the men's outline faded into the black river behind them. Vaguely, she felt a hot, sharp sickness in the pit of her stomach. Polk's hand was on her shoulder again, and this roused her from her stupor long enough to interrupt the man talking.
"Take me to him," she said. "I want to see my husband."
"Ma'am,"
the officer started.
"I've got a right to see the body of my husband. I've got a right. You take me to him, and then you bring us back home. He don't rest in some morgue. He rests in his own land."
"Ma'am, until the Department of Emergency Security completes its investigation, I'm afraid..."
"Goddamn cowards," Martina said. "There's not one real man among you. You just do whatever they say, don't you? No different than trained dogs. I hope it's your family next. I hope it's your family next."
"Once the investigation is complete, you'll be able to claim the remains."
"Get off my land," Martina said.
She bent down and dug into the mud and threw it at the officers. It landed in wet splatters on their uniforms and their boots. She bent down again, and this time the mud landed on the back of the officers' shirts as they walked to the boat. As he released the rope from the mooring, the younger of the two men turned briefly to face Martina.
"Sorry for your loss," he said.
Martina watched the boat vanish upriver, its outline glistening momentarily as it crossed the rippled crest of the moon's reflection on the water. And then it turned the bend and was gone. She heard Polk saying,
"He's with the Lord now. He's a martyr like mine."
"Go to the children," Martina said. "Make sure they get to bed. I'll be in soon."
"Honey, I won't leave you. Go on now. I'll be in soon."
She sent Polk back to the house, and for a while she stood alone near the muddy descent to the riverbank. She watched the black river, endless and endlessly moving. She walked north, the earth cool and damp against her feet. Soon she was among the sorghum, the brown pods of grain bunched around their stalks, hard as ball bearings. When she was far enough from her home that she knew the children would not hear, she fell to her knees and screamed. Excerpted from These the Calls of Our Blood, Dispatches from the Rebel South. The waking hours were the most unkind. She lay still in bed, the mind aflame, the body paralyzed, unable to face the day. She clutched her mother's butterfly brooch in her hand, its faded emerald stones smooth under her fingers. The nurses let her keep it after they ripped the pin from its back. This was in the days before,
before Julia Templestowe became the Rebel South's first martyr, its first killer, the patron saint of its war. It is often forgotten. There's always a before.